Hi, I'm Jerry Scullion, and you're listening to Gut Talks Double G U Double T.
Hi, I'm Jerry Scullion, and you're listening to Gut Talks Double G U Double T. Oh,
There you go.
Hi, everyone. I'm Maria, and welcome to Gut Talks Double G U Double T, a podcast I started to connect, reconnect, and meet like-minded individuals and put some karma on the board. In this episode, we put together an existing segment of Season 3. So instead of listening in batches, you get to listen to the entire conversation. We had over 89,000 downloads to date, starting from zero, with no sponsors, and it's a 100% self-funded podcast. Thank you so much for hanging around and listening to the episodes. And I have one ask only. I'd love to have your feedback to keep the show up to your expectations, so drop me a line at maria@gut.com, WGUWT.com. And like, share, or leave a review if you can. Now let's get started. Can I use all of them?
Yeah, use whatever you want. I don't.
Okay, cool. First of all, I like your background. So whoever is watching this as a video, I do like your background.
Thanks.
Jerry, we met online on a couple of occasions. I think I did enroll in one of your courses that was recommended by Adam Lawrence. So yes. He had like two tickets left and like two of us like, okay, we'll join. It was during COVID, I think. So yeah. And then we met online through other communities. So
Marcus and Florian and Adam ran a conference in Nuremberg called Teaming with AI. And I was sitting in a hotel room on my own in Nuremberg where the conference was on. It was kind of very meta. I was like, I'd flown all this way to be on a laptop in a hotel room where the conference was on two blocks away because they were doing a thing the night before. But anyway, you weren't there the day after, though, I don't think.
I was online, so it's like we went lonely in Nuremberg. Whenever everyone was online, so I was online, and we ended up in a room online together.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. I do remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was good fun. Yeah. I fell asleep, I think. I think I was... I got so comfortable in the conversation that I actually got into bed.
Actually, now I remember, it was a silent room. So we had different options. One of them was the silent room. So we ended up being in the silent room, but then other people joined and then it didn't end up being silent. So you left.
No. I left. I was starting to fall asleep. I was so tired like that day. I was like, I do remember being in a silent room. I was like, what is this? This is too experimental for my brain. So I left a silent room and a Zoom room online in the venue or in the city where the conference was. I was like, no, this is not for me. I'm going to bed.
I mean, it's part of the whole experimentation thing, right? And you're into that. And I just want to say, you're a podcaster too. So I don't think I've had many podcasters on this podcast. I think I had a couple maybe. And you've been running your podcast since 2017.
Yeah, 6 years. It's mad.
6 years. Do you want to say anything about this?
It started as a somewhat of a kind of a dare, I guess. I was like, can I do it and get it all set up in 28 days? And then it just kind of took a life of its own. And even like every time I say, oh, well, this is as many listeners as it can get, I just kind of go, okay, it's grown again and grown again. And the newsletter keeps on going bigger. Sorry, I need to stop my WhatsApp as well.
Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, it's just like, it's called the Human Centered Design Network. And it is a network. We have a private community there as well. That's a paid community for designers and change makers to get together and not just talk about making the world a better place. You've got a paid community and we run training as well. So we run training through thisishcd.com. Sounds like I'm on a sales pitch here. But I do coaching. That's how I make my money. How I kind of pay myself is through video-based coaching. So on-demand learning, in-person coaching or online coaching, and the private community and premium podcast. And oh, look, it's a nightmare. Anyone asks me that question when I'm out, they go, what do you do? I just kind of go, I'm a designer. That's probably what I say. I'm a designer. Yeah.
So you do one-on-one and one-to-many stuff online and in person.
Exactly. The coaching bit is where I really, really enjoy. I get like working with one-on-one change makers to try and create that space and hold space for them to have conversations about what might be holding them back as practitioners, any problems that they're currently facing in their teams. Because what I'm seeing at the moment is, generally speaking, leadership in organizations have a real challenge on their hands because some of them don't have any experience. And then the actual leaders within the design functions within the teams are so stretched, they're not able to give that level of nurturing or support to emerging talent. So that's kind of the gap that I'm hoping and trying daily to fill by connecting with these people and supporting them and working on a 12-week program to help them, you know, kick some goals.
So let's go back a bit in time, because you obviously have 20 years of experience as a designer.
Yeah.
And about 12 years, I think, as I read, right? Mm-hmm. Of experience in training, coaching, and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And you're based in Ireland?
Based in Ireland now, but I lived in Australia for 14 years. So when that's why, you know, if you look at anything that I do, there's always a bunch of Aussies in there. Like, you know, to me, they're the greatest people on earth. I love Australians so much because I identify as half Australian now and citizen of Australia, citizen of Ireland. So I'm on both fences. I've got my bum on Ireland and I've got my legs up on Australia. So I, you know, that's the way I like to say it to my friends and family. But yeah, so I spend an awful lot of time in Australia and I've been doing this for quite a while, as you said. Like, so I love it. But I'm always looking for people to work with. It's not a case I sit back and relax and, you know, kind of go, I don't know what I'll do this week. It's a constant struggle. That's one of the things I'd probably be interesting to talk about. Like, you know, it's not a it's not one of these jobs where you kind of sit back and relax and just let the work flow in. You have to be on 7 days a week. And that's kind of where I'm at in my career. Like, I have to fight to get the work in.
So let's go back. You're saying lots of like interesting things here, but I want to go back a bit in time. And I know
back in time. actually I do. Look, Back to the Future.
There we go. So no, thank you for that. I like all of those effects. So, you know, in my first and second season, I think I had a gong when I would talk us about, like, yeah, gut feelings, but then I dropped it. Sometimes it was too loud or not, and it would scare people sometimes. So I was like, okay. So my question here, I'm going to try to frame it in a way that makes sense. Now, tell me if I'm completely wrong, but I had a few conversations with a friend who's from Ireland.
Okay.
And he kind of relates to actually two different people, and they both kind of related to, you know, when I would say I'm from Lebanon, right? It's not something I like walk with, like, you know, a bit like you, like I don't really feel I completely belong to a place. I can be anywhere. I like meeting people, so it doesn't matter. But one thing here is they could relate to, you know, war, like lack of stability, you name it. So I want to ask you, how was your childhood like, or you being as like a teenager? What is it that led you to what you do today? Because you really got itchy feet, multiple things. Is there anything, any story, any memory? I don't know.
So I grew up in a small town outside of Dublin, and it was very small, but my father was from Northern Ireland and built the first supermarket in Northern Ireland, okay, in the 60s. So that's to give you an idea. And they had a post office next to it, and they had an agri business. It was like one of these kind of country stores, okay. But my mom was from Dublin and, you know, relocated up to the north during the Troubles. So Ireland as an island is made up of two countries. There's Northern Ireland and Ireland. And like the history of Northern Ireland is very complex, but basically involves the British coming over and holding space for 800 years, and generations of British people lived there and call it home, one of which is my wife. So my wife is Protestant, British, from Northern Ireland. I am, you know, Southern Ireland, Republic of Ireland, Catholic, And we're basically a product of a modern Ireland, is what I like to say. So the unity is still kind of, you know, a work in progress. But my parents relocated from the north due to the Troubles, and that shop, that post office, ultimately it was being held up, you know, by paramilitaries. We don't rear kids up here. So we moved down to Dublin. So it was always in my kind of consciousness that there was problems in our country. Okay, probably not too dissimilar to you growing up in the Lebanon. There was a noise, you know, we turn on the news in the 80s and we were still kind of finding our identity down the south, because we'd only been made a republic maybe 80 or 90 years ago. So we were still kind of trying to find our identity. We weren't really too sure who we were, but lots of things started to happen in the late 80s. U2 as a band started to get international success. Yeah. Riverdance, we started winning all these Eurovision contests. Guinness was being celebrated internationally. We were like, okay, things were, maybe we shouldn't be ashamed of all of these things that, like, you know, were happening in our country. There's reason to be positive. Okay, so Ireland went through a huge flux in the 90s. That's an F-L-U-X. And lots of change happened. Like, literally, we were there, and we went from in the 80s of being a relatively poor country into the 90s, where there was so much optimism. And I believe that period of the 80s and 90s, especially, I'm a Gen Xer, so we were change makers. It was in our DNA. We were questioning the church in Ireland. We were questioning who we were. We were questioning, this generation just questioned everything. Like, there must be better ways to do these things. And I ended up studying industrial design in Dublin, in Ireland, which was, I guess, I think that course is gone now. It's like a product design function, but really was more thinking holistically. So we incorporated some systems thinking and stuff. This was in the late 90s. So really, I wouldn't hold much credit to my third level education. I didn't particularly value that whole experience of becoming an industrial designer, but it wasn't really until I got to Australia where I found that design was being valued and design had a seat at the table, and you didn't have to sell what you were doing in as much as you would have to do it in other places, I found. But anyway, that's a really kind of a story about my childhood and where I got to. But I think the whole kind of the fire, the itch, as you say, in the feet, it came from that whole kind of desire to make things better. And I still believe it. I still hold it true. Like, it's something I whisper into my children's ear every day. I'm like, come on, what voice are you hearing inside your head today? Who are you? Come on, let's try and do it. Like, you know, so that's the attitude I have. And it's my makeup. You know what I mean?
So is it what took you to Australia?
Took me to Australia. Beautiful women, beautiful beaches. Only joking. I'll tell you what happened, right? It was really interesting because in my final year, there's lots of synchronicities happening around that period in my life. Okay. And it's funny, I interviewed Hector Garcia, the author of this great book, the other day, and we had a brilliant conversation. Yeah. Hector is based in Japan, and these two books on Ikigai. One is The Japanese Secret to a Long and Healthy Life, and the other one is The Journey to Ikigai. Highly recommend checking those books out. But we talked about synchronicities quite a lot. And I ended up partnering with another designer for my final year project. And it was like a taxi for the future. And it's only now, like, when you look at it, you kind of go, it was bicycle-led. It was like effectively like a modern cargo bike for London. And this was in 2001. Right, that was electric powered, and we won the Student Design Award of the Year with the Royal Society of Arts in London, and Ford and Bugatti gave me and him a bursary to do something to catapult ourselves. And I catapulted myself as quickly as I could to Sydney, which it was in 2003. And for anyone who's into rugby, this is the Rugby World Cup year, and it just happened to coincide with the Rugby World Cup, okay, which was held in Australia. So I went out to the Rugby World Cup and I stayed for the year, and I learned that I did not want to do industrial design anymore. I wanted to do a thing called human computer, or HCI, basically. I'm not going to spell it out. And I tried to get a job, couldn't get a job, came home to Ireland. And I was like, I've read all these books, Steve Krug, like, Don't Make Me Think and all this kind of stuff. And I was well read after a year away, sitting on a beach reading about this stuff, but I couldn't get a job. literally couldn't get a job because it was still design, decoration. They were the same thing. So that's a bit of a nutshell. What took me to Australia? The first time it was the RSA gave me a bursary fund. They got me out there. Second time was for my now wife. She wanted to go out for a year. And I was at that stage had desires to become a musician and had a manager in America and stuff like that. And I remember doing a website for somebody for cash under the table and going into Trail Finders. Is that what they're called? They're the Trail Finders, they're a UK company. And I got paid 3,000 in cash. And I went in and I was like, ticket to Australia, please. It was like you'd see in a movie like Snatch or something. Like it was like, put the money on the table, boom, ticket. Like, I bought it on the Tuesday and I was Australian the Thursday. And I got out there really quickly. And it was so quick, in fact, that my weekly catch up with my manager at the time, who was in America, they were like, hey, why are we doing a call at my nighttime? Shouldn't you be in bed? And I go, well, no, it's my morning. I'm in Sydney. And she was like, what are you doing in Sydney? And I was like, I followed out my girlfriend. And she was like, no, you're not meant to be out there. You're meant to be in Dublin. You're meant to be coming over here. And I was like, nah, change of plan. So I followed my heart. You know, it was a good lesson.
So do you still follow your heart or your gut?
Well, I'm speaking to you, aren't I? The gut talks. Do I still follow my heart? Well, I haven't had to really follow it since that time. Like, you know, I still follow my my instinct, I guess. It's probably a nice way of saying it, like my inner voice. But I would be very suspicious of my gut, I have to say. Like, it's not something that in my younger years I would have relied on and went, oh, my gut is trying to tell me something here. But now with wisdom, I question my gut. I kind of, maybe it's the beans, or maybe it's something else trying to tell me that I need to question things a lot more. So I'm much more of an evaluative person than I was maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago. Now I definitely weigh things up and I look at the pros and cons at a much, I guess I'm thinking more medium and long term than I am just short term.
Okay, so the older you get, kind of.
I'm now 28, so why does everyone laugh when I say that? I am not in my 30s. I'm not in my 50s. I'm below 45. There you go, folks. Yeah, I do question things a lot more. But when I do commit, I commit fully. And that's the difference, I think. Just the going with your gut instinct, I think too many people can really hold that to be like, oh, it's another voice trying to tell us some stuff. It's my process at the moment and it seems to work, but it'll probably change again. Like, you know, that's what I'm learning. I'm not the whole thing about balance is what I'm trying to get to here. Probably a little bit of everything to inform the decision is critical in my experience.
So you do multiple things, right? And you said rightly, like, I'm a designer. That's what you say when someone asks you, because you do multiple things. And, you know, design is a link throughout everything you do, right?
Yeah.
In the way you approach things. And so you deciding to go into education and training and working on projects and coaching and like podcasting, right? And then I don't know what's next, like building a community, like different things. How have you been making the decisions of going into all of this and managing all of this? Because it's quite a lot.
Yeah, it is quite a lot. I question why I'm doing it most days. Like, I'm like, there's other ways I can make a living. Could go work for the man. And it's this constant fight. It's like the pros and cons. I could go and probably work for a consultancy and stuff, but I wouldn't feel really satiated. I wouldn't feel really like I'm achieving what I want to do. There's very few businesses out there that I think that could really accept me at this stage of my life. Like, you know, I remember I did a talk years and years ago and it was in Dublin and I talked about redesigning design and how design is hitting its limitations. And I've since given an update in that talk and how we've passed it. Like, you know, we need to radically rethink things. And I remember afterwards, someone coming up to me saying, I really enjoyed your talk. I was like, oh, thank you. That's nice. And they're like, but we could never bring you into the bank. And I go, why? And they go, because you're too much of an agitator. And I go, I don't think I'm talking about anything that's too radical here. I said, I'm just talking about really questioning things. And there is this kind of sense with a lot of people out there, and I'm speaking on behalf of my coachees and stuff, you kind of have to toe the line at some point, and which I agree with to a point. But we do need to ask those questions. We're not paid to be compliant. We're paid to point at the problems and ideally like help solve some of those problems. But sometimes organizations don't want to hear it. I remember, like, sorry, I'm jumping between Billy and Jack here. When I was in government in Australia, one of the executives refused to speak to me. Okay, like they just referred to me as scullion. And I'm like, how offensive. And it was all because the research that I was bringing back at the time didn't fall in line with what their mandate was. And I didn't, like, I am, you know, you asked me what I was like in school, what I was like as a teenager, I was really good. I never got into trouble, apart from that one time where I was drinking underage in a pub. But I never really got into trouble, like serious trouble. And like for me, when I go and do a job, I will always give it my full. Like if I take on anyone's projects, I will always give it my full attention to make sure that they are completely satisfied. It's something that baked into us. I think service designers really want to make sure that they're providing a service. But for me, when I'm doing research for organizations, it's not about validating what they want to hear. It's about bringing back those stories that challenge and make them rethink and hopefully become more research led or human led, whatever you want to say.
You still do that, right?
Take on specific projects if they align to where I'm at. Like, because if I'm taking on consultancy type work, it takes me away from training and then my availability. Mm-hmm. And, you know, truthfully, the training can be more lucrative and it frees me up to do other stuff. Whereas if I'm doing consultancy, they tend to buy it on a day by day basis. So you're kind of like, okay, I'm locked out now for 20 days. And you got to do that work. And then suddenly I can't record and I suddenly can't, you know, do other little bits of training here and there, or I can't write or I can't record. Like, there's cameras all over this room. So I'm ready to record whenever I want. Mm-hmm. I never have to set up to record a video or any of this kind of stuff. It's just ready to go. Like, you know, that's how I designed this space up here. It's in my attic in my house. So those kind of projects, they're few and far between, but if they're for governments or if they're for places that I really feel connected to that problem, then I'll make it work, like, you know.
So just a quick one here. You said you question everything. I totally relate to that. I've always been questioning everything as a kid, like anything. And sometimes it causes like headaches, like, I don't get headaches, but it's like overthinking, like stop it, you know? It's like, but in professional settings, it's like, this is the challenge where they ask you to come in because it might sound, we're kind of jumping here into design being like a fancy thing. Research can sound a fancy thing. We want to be seen doing it as an organization, right?
Yeah.
But then they know exactly where they want to get to. And then here you have like this friction where, okay, like this is what you are paid to do. This is what you believe like you can add in terms of value to them. And they just don't want to see it. Yeah. So lots of things get wrapped into the whole like design thinking and let's play with a bunch of post-it notes and whatever. You mentioned at the beginning, you kind of listened to Adam Lawrence's episode on Gut Talks too. How do you see things?
Adam.
How do you see things now? Like, how were they before? How do you see the evolution? What's your view, if you want, or take on that? Idea of research. Research with, if you want, led research by organization. Get to that, like, goal-driven organization with an internal goal.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no one answer. There's no one answer to it, like... It depends. I'd like to know just how they operate. How are they making decisions? And where are the voices of the people being woven into those decisions? That's really at its core what we're trying to do. Like, we're trying to match that whole need and hidden need, and as often the case, to how they design these things, whether they're products or services. Same thing, really. But anyway.
Yes.
So... it's really important. Like, I feel like we've been banging our heads against a wall. Well, I have for 20 years. Like, it's like, oh, obviously. So you asked a little bit more around kind of what I do and why I got into training and so forth.
Yeah.
So when I was in Australia, I started working in government in the last 4 years before I left Australia. And it was the first time that I felt like I was seeing things. Okay. It was, I can't describe it. It was like a light went on in my head is the way I can describe it. For a long time, I was blind. You know, I'm white, I'm man. And a lot of the times I was paid to work in companies that, you know, probably weren't doing it very well. And I was part of that problem. And then when I started working in government, I started to see social problems and the inequalities. And I remember one time I was working way outside of Sydney, you know, over in the West, in Sydney, for anyone who's listening in Australia. But I was sitting in court for a whole week, which sounds like a nightmare to some people, but it was incredible. Okay. Because I was seeing all of these court cases coming up, and for anyone who's got a spare day, folks, just go to court, just go to court and sit in the back. You learn so much about life. But I really wanted to create something that I could point at and say, this is what design is, as opposed to having those same conversations. And that's where the podcast came out of. It was something, this is human-centered design, not the IDEO kind of framework, the double diamond, the design thinking kind of approach. This is a mindset. This is what we're talking about. This is the stuff to get us rethinking things. When I came home from Australia, I took a role at a consultancy and my head did 360 degrees 100 times within about 3 months. I was like, this is awful. This is not what it's about. Like, you know, this is, I was the complete antithesis. Everything that I believed in, like, it was just like, it was just not the right space for me, the right place either. And I said, you know, what we really need to do is get stuck more into the education side of things and give affordable, flexible spaces to learn that really help push the craft. And that's when, you know, myself and Mark, Mark Stickdorn, who's Adam's collaborator. So I know Adam through Mark. We started to collaborate together, and that's where This Is Doing came out of during the pandemic. And it was a great experience and it was a great experiment. But I guess over the last couple of years, we've all worked independently. This Is Doing is still going. Mark, Adam and Marcus run that. I'm no longer involved in This Is Doing, but the education space became really, really interesting to me from a service design perspective. But I felt that if we were, like, I trained thousands of people in the last couple of years, and I started to question the effectiveness of people going back into their organization. I'm giving you a really long answer here. I where is this coming from? I don't know. But basically, I question the effectiveness of training when they go back into the organizations and the organizations suppress any of these new radical ideas to do things differently. And that's where I started to really scratch the itch of the Makers and Doers School that I launched. I've been working on it for about 9 months and I'm holding it up here. Like, this is like a little booklet that I give to all the kids. We ran a prototype of a summer camp. We'll do it this way, it's a bit better. So, like, become a scientist and all the different mindsets that you need to do during the become a detective. So, and it was amazing. I'd never taught 6-year-olds and 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds 4-5 days in a row, and I've never been as tired as I was on that Friday. I remember just kind of like getting into my car and just shriveling down behind the steering wheel and kind of rocking back and forth. But it was amazing. Like, they made such a leap from Monday to Friday. They were questioning things, they were doing things differently, they were asking questions. And that, some of that was just due to the fact that they got to know me a bit better, but it was a really interesting experience, and it's definitely something I want to do more of. It's just trying to find the right business model to make it sustainable.
What is it that got you into kids, basically?
I have kids. That's what got me into kids. There's no other way of saying it. Like, they say, I remember when I was working in government in Australia, Jerry Gaffney, he's this incredible user experience designer. He calls me my childhood nickname, Scully. He's like, Scully, you're ruined now. You're going to have kids. You're not going to be able to take on the type of work you've been taking. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Would you go away from me? This is why we'd speak to each other, because he's Irish and I'm Irish. And he was right. Like, no one told me when you had kids, your brain gets rewired. And you have this whole kind of It was literally like I was waking her up and I was a different person little by little every day. And we have two kids, Freya and Sam. Freya is 6.5 and Sam is 4. And just watching them develop and then realizing like there's not enough stimulus happening in education. And there's an awful lot of talk about it, but not an awful lot of doing. And like, that's no discredit to the teachers out there. The teachers in Ireland in particular are absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. But there's a huge gap there between reality. It could be extracurricular stuff. That's the way I position it at the moment. But I'm really interested in the designing for home experience. That's the bit that I feel providing the material, and I mean that in educational material and physical material, to play in a relatively unstructured / structured way through guidance is the area that I'm probably going to be taking that business, because it allows it to scale, it allows it to become more community-led, and it's relatively flexible. But I really want to give that kind of fodder, F-O-D-D-E-R, fodder to the children and the parents and the schools ultimately as well, to try and push it forward. And I'm not working on it on my own. There's two other people, Mairead and Alexa, who, that's another story for you, by the way. They've helped me with the workshop that we did at the summer camp, or summer course, as we should probably be calling it, because it's not really like a summer camp. But they're amazing. Like, they're much more on the art side of things, and I'm coming at it from a design perspective.
Yeah, there's lots here. I mean, that's a topic on its own, actually, when you go back to the whole education system everywhere. It's like even it's been the same for ages with a bit of nuances, maybe. And we don't hear a lot like people talking about this. The only thing that you hear, or at least that I've heard about a lot, is like they don't teach you business at school, but there is much more to it. It's not just a business, like it's what you're saying, like questioning things and asking the right questions. This is essential, and if kids can start doing that early on, then their life will be different. So
absolutely. I mean, well, business has got us into the position where we're at now at the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, like the business success is usually profit, selling, you know, needs, that whole kind of mindset needs to be questioned. There's nothing wrong with business, by the way, and there's nothing wrong with profit. And I know my
nothing wrong. I think here. That's important, actually. It's, we need this.
Yeah.
Because
absolutely.
We get taught, how to be like, how to obey somehow, like how to be good at what you do, but not how to get things done and not be shy just to get out, or afraid to get out and do things. And that's what's missing.
You mean get out, like, and clear your head and walk and do things?
No, like
when you say get out.
Get out means like talk to people, try, like interact.
Oh, yeah.
Learn, exactly. Explore.
Exactly. Like,
try, test. Yeah.
So be curious. Like, you know, that's what everyone says. Like, oh, I look for curiosity. And, you know, you see it in the job descriptions. Be curious. I'm like, yeah, that's great. Like, you know, and I guarantee you, if you had 1,000 people interviewing here at the moment, none of them would say, do you know what? I'm not curious. Like, no, I'm not curious. I just want to be told what to do. Human nature, I would argue that most people are curious. They want to do things better. They want to do these things and question. But what tends to happen is the lack of leadership who are just in line with business and making profit, and they don't question the other stuff. So the humanities, this whole angle and argument for why we do what we do and how we do what we do needs to be really brought up. And it's funny, like I did this really, this experiment. And the night before, I was like, on the Tuesday night, I said, I'm going to do something with these kids. On the Wednesday, I'm gonna give them a physical way of exploring experimentation. And there was a gym next to the space where we did it, and I was like, "said how am I gonna do it? Like, how can I walk them through this process?" So we took them down to the gym, and I lined them all up against the wall, and I said, "Okay, it was a basketball court. There was a circle in the middle, and I said, okay, what we're gonna do is we have to roll the ball, and it has to land." It has to stop in the circle. And they're all like 6, 7, 8 years old. There's like 25 of them. So the first person come up and they rolled it, and the ball went beyond. It's very hard to have it slow down at that point. Well, the next bunch of people came and they rolled it really slowly and wasn't fast enough to get to the middle. And I was like, okay, everyone stop. What's happening here? And they go, we can't get it to stop where we want it to stop. And there was one child, Ollie is his name. He's 8 and he was so cool. And he was, you know, he's a super smart, really bright child. And he got up and he was a bit taller than the others. And I said, what are you doing with the ball? He was going to bounce it. And I go, why are you going to bounce it? And he was like, because it's going to reduce its friction. I said to myself, I'm like, bloody hell. I said, you're so smart. So he bounced it and it just missed it. Like it slowed down. He says, it'll slow down with the bounces. And I'm like, ah, very clever. So no one got it in the first round. And I said, okay, so after the first round, I said, tell me what you're all learning. And they said, well, we know that rolling isn't going to really work. But what Ollie did was interesting. This is what they're all saying to me. So we think that they're kids, like the kids won't get it. So I was like, okay, the next time they all started to bounce it and 5 of them got it the second time. So the next time the third chance came around, 10 of them got it. And I was like, what are you learning? And this is, we're learning from each other. And I'm like, right, exercise done, folks. I'm going to charge your parents an extra €1,000 for this week. Because that lesson in on its own, we could give it to, you know, organizations. And it was a really small exercise. Some of the kids really got it. They really like connected with it. They're like, You could see the light bulbs going off and lighting up. And, you know, they were kind of like, yeah. That is true. Like, you know, other kids just weren't really that. They were like, give me the ball. I want to kick it. I'm not that naive, but it was an amazing thing for me to see. I'm going to have another coffee here. Don't mind me.
Yeah, sure.
So that's kind of like in a nutshell what the Makers and Doers is about. It's really fascinating. I just need to figure out the business model so I don't go broke doing it. You know what I mean? I get no government assistance or nothing like that. I lost several thousand on that week alone just from the prototype. So I've only got a couple of more stabs before I try and figure out the business model.
How did you get started? And did you find like the kids or, I mean, the parents, obviously, or did you try to find partners first?
No, it's a good question. I had been talking about it for about 4 years. Okay. And few people have messaged me on Twitter and stuff saying you should explore this. And I was like, there's no business model there that'll make it work. I was kind of very skeptical initially. But what I did is I did Instagram tests. So I set up an Instagram page and I had a couple of landing pages and I ran €50 tests for a couple of weeks. And different propositions on each, and I could see what were things were being clicked. Mm-hmm. Funny enough, I got banned off Facebook off that. I was
really?
Like,
yeah. They banned a lot, actually. Why? Did you know why?
And I spent €500 with an agency who speak to the sport team in Facebook.
Yeah.
And they just said, no, we can't give a reason. Just banned. And I was like, it must be something to do with the fact that there was a child, a photo of a child in one of the ads. That's the only thing we can think of. But I wasn't able to do any more of the ads. And by the way, I hate Facebook. I hate them. Yeah. Hate everything about them. Hate Zuckerberg. Hate them. So hate all those things. And it's a really strong word people say. Like, I just probably hate's a strong word, but like, I really dislike them. And I especially dislike them after that because I was like, hey, look. But anyway, I got enough of an interest about, is there a market there? And spoke to a lot of people who registered on the newsletter. I said, hey, can I chat to you on the phone? This is what I'm trying to do. And I got loads of insights. Like, parents are not shy of telling you what they want. It's not like you have to scratch below the surface and try and determine the need. They were telling you what they want, which was really good. And the ultimate test is putting the hand in the pocket. Are they going to buy something? And they did. So they did buy, and it was good. We didn't charge enough, which I knew anyway, but I just wanted to get people in for an experience and experiment. It's on the Makers and Doers School, or Makers and Doers School on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of hundred people in there that followed it. But really, you know, it was a prototype. It was a learning experiment. And I'm going to start talking more around the experiments of designing the business, because I think the parents are really interested in that. Like, what are you doing with it? How's it working? So yeah, that's kind of how I got it started.
I like the story because it's like basically what
service
you teach.
Design.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but
amazing.
What was the pitch? What? When you said you were talking to lots of people, what was the pitch to them?
Designing, I was empowering the next generation of thinkers and doers. That was the tagline. And I think I used the phrase design thinking because it resonates with parents who may not know what human-centered design. And some people then went on to discover the podcast and they'd ask me questions about it when they're picking up the kids. And I guess some people are probably a little bit more suspicious of human-centered design if you don't know what it is, because I talk about it like a mindset, which gets into the world of spirituality and, you know, all that kind of stuff, where I don't talk about that really at the kids, but I do introduce them to sustainability and stuff that impacts our health and our life and following your purpose. We did speak about that. One of the most rewarding pieces on that week, and I can't wait to do it again, was working with children who are relatively shy. And, you know, not putting them on the spot by saying, now's your time to present. Like really seeing if they wanted to share what they were creating. And I was like, who's interested in coming up in the chair with me and holding them on the chair and watching them talk about what they created? Sometimes they'd be whispering in my ear, like, this is a little theater, like with little people. And then by the end of it, they would all be like, come on, you can talk out louder. Like, you're not talking to me. I mean, if he knows, because the hay fever, the window's open. I don't have a drug problem. And so it was really, really nice to see children kind of build that trust with their group of people and, you know, co-learn with each other. And I mean, that's like, I'm sure teachers out there are just kind of like, yeah, this is a normal Monday to Friday tool for us. But when you're looking at it from a training perspective or a design perspective, you don't see an awful lot of that happening in organizations. You don't see enough of it where people want to talk about it, want to share. It's still very much siloed. And that was the bit that was really heartwarming for me. And I really believe the generation that we're working with in education at the moment, they're a different breed. These yeah. kids are going to be like, you know, designing us under the table in 10 years. Like, you know, they're super smart, like super bright.
They are. And sometimes one may assume that, yeah, they're just kids.
No,
but they can do wonders, right? And they're smart and they are sponges. I was super shy actually as a kid. I would never say anything.
Really?
Yes.
And look at you now. Look at
well,
you.
I still am somehow, but yeah, I mean, if I look back, I'm like, oh my God, I mean, I'm a different person.
Yeah.
And
what changed?
What changed?
Yeah, for you. What worked for you?
I was already in my 20s, to be honest, but it's... it was when I made the decision, first of all, to get out of my circle and where I was
mm-hmm.
and around people I knew. I wanted to be around people. No one knew anything about me. So yeah. I felt more comfortable. And the other part was the key one is I decided to say yes to things and just yeah. go for it. And that was a mental rough road actually to decide and to apply actually. That was the key part. But yeah. then this is what changed it for me. It's like, I don't care and I'm just going to
well,
do stuff.
It's funny. That's one of the things that Hector Garcia said the other day in his podcast. We were talking about saying yes to everything for a period of time and then going into monk mode. I love, he called monk mode. I'm like, yeah, I'm a monk mode. But it was saying yes to everything is one of the best things. And what difference did that have for you then? What happened when you started saying yes to everything? You must have been drunk every single night of the week. You coming out tonight? Yes.
Funny thing is I don't drink.
Neither do I.
Yeah, I don't drink. So I put it that way. I don't eat anything that is bitter. I don't drink coffee and I don't drink alcohol. I only drink a glass of Prosecco with my neighbors.
For breakfast.
That I'm saying today. No. yeah, and that's it. Never liked it. I also went to Mykonos, funny enough, with friends. And they're telling me, are you sure? I said, yeah. They're like, are you sure? And I felt like they didn't really want me to come until I realized, like, okay, this is what they meant. And I was just up partying between brackets, just standing up with everyone drunk around me. So I was just like, yeah. So
they were in bed late the next day, and you were the one who was like, up early, like, you know, watching the sunrise.
Yes. So, anyway, well, I mean, this podcast is about you, but I'll answer the question.
No, it's about both of us. Like, people want to know about you, I'm sure.
Yeah, you know, I feel as we're moving along with this podcast, because obviously I had no idea what we would be talking about, which I like. Yeah. I knew it was going to be fun and interesting. It's because you're a podcaster also.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know more about you. For people to know about, you know, some backstories. Saying yes, I remember, I think I was in Cyprus, and I was kind of planning to go back to Italy, and I got a scholarship, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to go back, start again, whatever.
Yeah.
Even though I was like, okay, start again, like, does it make sense? And I'm like, you know what? It's kind of a sign, like, you know, sometimes you get things, just go along. What's the worst thing that's going to happen? And I was kind of on holidays also back then. I was like, I'm going to say yes. And whatever comes my way, I'm just going to say yes and explore and see what happens. So I started doing that all the time in any kind of decision. I mean, I can't recall everything, but that was the first one. But then I started also opening up more. Like, I had this thing, and my mom always, my mom always used to tell me, when someone says, how are you, say, very well, thank you. And you, like, don't just say, I'm good, thank you. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah. Just say, and you, like, you know, just don't end it here. Yeah, but when I was, before also in Italy, I was also studying. So I think I had some students from other masters who would come and ask me to give them feedback on their projects.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, like, I'd never understood why. But I was also just trying to meet everybody, going to all the masters, to all the lectures, just meet people. Like, I knew pretty much everyone. So But them coming to me was something where, like, that some friends picked up on, and they were like, you should teach.
Mm-hmm.
And then I applied to teach, like, late, like a year after, and I got in. And when I got in after 2 weeks, because they needed someone, and actually I knew after that they had to take someone else. But then when I applied, they decided to take me first. I was like, okay, I'm so not ready for this. I was freaking out. And then I said, okay, if I don't do it now, it might never happen again.
Yeah.
Like, things happen. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah.
I looked like the students. Like, I was, they thought I was a student, put it that way. But yeah, things like that. So
we're all students, aren't we, at the end of the day? Like, you know,
yes,
this was
yes.
Polytechnico di Milano, isn't it?
Were
you teaching?
No. So that was when I was teaching in Lebanon. And then after, I started teaching in Italy. So I moved to Italy in 2010. Then I went back to Lebanon in 2011, went back in 2015. I was still, so my brain was elsewhere and my body was in Lebanon at some point. And then I was like, kind of, okay, what do I do now? So yeah,
it's, you know, training and education, they're very similar. There is a little bit of a difference. I think it's really rewarding, like, when you get a good group of people who really want to learn and they're open to different ways of learning. It's so rewarding, like, it really is. Like, you go home at the end of the day and you don't feel tired. You feel empowered. Like, that's the way it is for me anyway. It's I love it. Literally love it, like, you know.
I think when I started teaching, I had a colleague that I would call my mentor, because I was always going out with her. I wanted to learn you know, more. She had like 25 years of experience teaching, and she still is great. And she could bring, like, get the students to do things that are unthinkable. Put it that way, in like their first year.
Yeah.
So I remember she told me, if you have, let's say, the whole class doing stuff, but if you have one student who kind of sees something, discovers something, that would make your day. She said, it's so true. And I remember later that year, I was staying like after hour with a student, just going through stuff or project. And then at some point, you know, after, let's say, I think it was after like 3 months or so working on this same project, she was like, oh, and a long O, And that for me was like a highlight, I think, for life. Yeah. It's like, this is what I look for when I do stuff. If it's training, like, you know, professionals and companies, or if it's teaching, like, you know, students or whatever that may be.
Yeah.
This is like brilliant.
That's it. I mean, I have this phrase that I say to people when I'm training, like, my role here is to bring 30%. So you bring the 70%, all of you together. And I'm like, I can do that 30% in my sleep. Okay, right. I can knock 30% out, you know, very quickly. I said, can you bring the 70%? And we have that kind of, it's a social contract, effectively. It's what Adam does as well, an awful lot. Yeah. And they're like, hang on a sec, he's only going to bring 30%. That's a fail. I was like, yeah. I said, like, so I'm going to give you the stuff. It's up to you what you want to do with it. And I was like, if this is a bad session at the end of the day, I've done my 30%. I get paid for the 30%. Like, you know, I'll be feeding back on the other stuff. So come on, let's do it. Like, you know, and it's really true. Like, you know, it's, we can show up, we can bring our stuff, but at the end of the day, it's down to the participants if they really want to learn. And that's what's good, but it's also kind of what's bad. You know, I'd love to be able to have a recipe to say, like, you know what, I'm just going to rock up, you can fall asleep, and at the end of it, you're going to have the information. But unfortunately, we still haven't figured that one out. Like, you know, ChatGPT, how do you make that happen?
There we go. So you're jumping into that. So I think this, it's what we're talking about here is really, I mean, there are plenty of stories. It, yeah. Going back to what you say, or what you said, actually, I remember last year I had like a couple of students who just couldn't be asked too much anyway. They just wanted to go out and party and travel all the time. And then they would come back to me and like, just tell me stuff. And then I told them, listen, guys, I know. So if you're not putting in any kind of thoughts in what you're doing, I know. So don't try to just come back to me. Tell me I didn't have time, whatever. But if you want me to help you,
yeah,
just, same. You know, just to do some work and tell me. Otherwise, I can't help you because, you know what? I don't have the answers anyway. So exactly. I think it's really common. That's why we're kind of on the same wavelength. Yeah. There are lots of stories here. So
absolutely. Absolutely.
You're using, going back to ChatGPT, I listened to your episode. I think we mentioned Adam about 10 times on this podcast. He's on holidays now, so I'm gonna let him know. So you interviewed Adam and Marcus after teaming up with AI. So this is what we started off talking about during this podcast. And you said you have this love and hate kind of relationship with AI.
Yeah. Yeah, still, yeah.
Still, okay.
Yeah, it's you know, we still haven't figured that out. We're working on it as we go along. I love it, and I also hate it in some ways because I can see how it's going to be misused. It's not like if, it's more like when. I just think it needs to be more considered in its, how it's being applied. You know, tech hasn't really built an awful lot of trust with people over the last 10 or 15 years. So I just, like, that's where my suspicion comes from. It's not a case of, you know, I'd never use it. I do use it, like, you know, but I just think it's at that point where it could really become out of hand very quickly.
You're talking specifically about like generative AI kind of ChatGPT.
Generative AI, like, you know, the stuff around deep fakes.
Yeah.
Using it within musician, kind of like to lean into their data sets, you know, even looking at Spotify and all of these places, like, how do those artists who are not even providing their data set, they're just taking their data set, how are they going to be included in the future? How are we going to, it's those quandaries. It's not, and no one has the answer to it. That's what becomes clear. Like, it's just a case of, like, it's going to happen, much like, whenever Spotify and Napster were coming out in 99, 2000, 2001, we're going to have to get ready for it very quickly. But, you know, if we thought it was bad whenever things went digital in the banks and people were asking for stuff, it's going to get 100 times worse or 1,000 times worse once AI starts getting involved and you start having all these problems. So it's definitely one to remain focused on, I think. But Adam, Marcus and Florian in Nuremberg, that conference was really good. And I nearly didn't go. If it wasn't for Marcus, he rang me and he was like, will you come over? And I go, no, I can't afford it. It's too expensive. And then he was like, it's not that expensive. I looked at your flights to come over. Come on. And I was like, the story behind that one is really funny because I bought the Playmobil Pro Kit, which they actually worked with Frank Mueller on, and for the kids stuff. And I'd said to my wife, like, oh, look, you know, there's no real material out there. I had to use the Playmobil Pro Kit, like in a structured way. And Adam or Marcus had said, look, oh, come on over and we'll show you. Like, and then in the same breath on WhatsApp, this event, I just assumed, didn't even look at the link. I just looked at when the dates were. And for a week or two, I was like saying, so how do you weave the Playmobil Pro Kit into the AI stuff? And he's like, what are you talking about? And I go, I've bought my flights. I said, I want to go over and learn more about the Playmobil Pro. And he's like, oh, no, that was a separate thread. So I originally bought the tickets going to teaming with AI, not knowing what it was really fully about. I knew it was about AI, but I thought there was going to be something else around facilitation and using the externalization of these tools. But yeah, that was originally where it all came about. Like, but Marcus and Adam, they're really generous. They give an awful lot of time. They're helping push the craft. So yeah, it's I don't know if they're running it again, but it's definitely one, if you're around that neck of the woods or if you're interested in it, check out Teaming with AI. I'm not paid to say that. I just really think it's really important.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I mean, I was in the online one, but I enjoyed that one as well. Did you get a chance to play with AI and Playmobil?
Oh, yeah.
Pro? Okay.
Instead of the Pro Kit here, like, you know, I have it at home and we used it in the Makers and Doers School. And it was good fun. And I play with AI all the time. You know what I mean? I try and learn these different things. But I probably could do an awful lot more. To me, it's still kind of trying to figure out. It's a solution and I'm looking for a problem for it. Like, you know.
As a musician, do you also play with AI?
No, I don't. Okay. I'm still really old school. Still have all my guitar pedals in a big box through the side of this attic over here. So I'm still kind of analog in playing music and stuff. I look at all these people on YouTube and going, God, that is so cool. You can do this kind of stuff. Wow, loop stations. That's cool. No, I'm still really old school. I still have my electric guitars and all my acoustics and it still comes out of my hands. It doesn't come out of any AI. So that's what I do. And plus, no one in AI can beat my rendition of Baby Shark and the ukulele. So that is still what gets played mostly in my house downstairs on the uke.
I remember you had the background with your guitars, but I can't see them here.
Oh, yeah, actually. There's probably a little bit over here. Just some of them. You could just see one neck.
Oh, I see one here. Yeah, okay.
Dark on that side of the room.
Is there anything you would like to discuss? Because I know that obviously there are many things we didn't dive too much into coaching or into podcasting or into the community. Is there anything you would like to talk about?
No, we've covered off an awful lot of stuff. Like the areas that I'm kind of most focused on is building out the coaching practice and building out the community. Mm-hmm. We announced yesterday, actually last night, about moving the podcast to a premium model, which is radical. We're nearly at 1 million downloads.
Nice.
So it's at that point where we're like, okay, you know what? We need to separate things a little bit. You know, there's the whole kind of world of free doesn't really work. You know what I mean? Like, so mm-hmm. We've partnered with Spotify and I had other stuff going on with other advertisers and some people don't like it. I'm like, oh, that's cool. If you don't like it, then you can support it, you know. Mm-hmm. And that is, so we've split the feeds up. People say, like, there's all these softwares out there that can make it really easy to do. My God, it was so much pain trying to structure all these things because it's so rudimentary, podcasts. And then you're kind of doing it in the live setting as well. So you're kind of Spotify. That's where Spotify, I wasn't able to do it before when I wasn't with Spotify. And they were really kind and they did end up getting on Zoom calls with me. I know I was chatting to you about that before. But it's all fully set up and it really excites me about having a separate stream where it's not like a Patreon. It's more like you actually reward people and have a really separate type of engagement with people who listen and pay and reward those people who really want to be part of something. And that really feeds nicely into the community. We've only got about 8 people in our community who are paying. And that community is like a design gym. That's what one of the people were calling it, where it's more of a space for practicing little things and supporting and facilitating and talking about social change and what we need to do more of. So I wouldn't say it's a bazillion miles away from activism. It's full of people who are interested in that space. And that's really rewarding for me. And I love facilitating those kind of conversations. So you can check out thisishcd.com if you want. Buy a course means I can buy my favorite Diablo pizza on a Friday night by supporting my courses. It's today Friday, it is, isn't it?
Pizza. Today's Friday.
Night. Pizza night tonight.
And Guinness.
No, I don't drink. So,
you don't either. Okay.
No, I don't. I gave it up a year ago. It was funny. I thought I was on my own. I was like, hey, you know, I'm going to be the freak who doesn't drink, you know, and I get what you were talking about before, people trying to convince you to drink and stuff. And my wife was like, you can still have one or two. Like, you know, I go, no, I just don't want any. I'm so against it. And I said it to a few people, and it turns out you probably know Lou Down, you know, from Good Services. They gave up the booze about a month after me, nothing to do with me, just completely incidental. Sarah Drummond, they also gave up the booze. And, you know, I feel great. There's certain times when I got my kids and they're like, you know, doing my absolute head in, and where I feel like I just want to have, you know, a couple of shots or something to take the edge off. But you know what? You know, a can of Coke or something else will, you know, calm me down a little bit.
That's sugar. It will calm me down and make you fall asleep after.
No, just something like a treat or something. That usually makes me feel a little bit better, like something that I probably shouldn't be having. But I do not miss alcohol at all. I do miss Guinness, though, and I don't get into this one. Guinness is separate. Guinness is like a, you know, it's more of a ritual in Ireland when you're having a good pint of Guinness. It's a sense of calm watching your pint get ready for you. So, yeah, anyway, that's it.
You mentioned a few people in the design community kind of at large who gave up alcohol.
I know more people who've given up alcohol. And
why why did you do it, like yourself?
My mental health. I gave it up. I wasn't drinking too much, but I have really had to focus on it over the last couple of years. The pandemic was not kind to me. It was like it really knocked me for six. There was periods where I thought I was going to die after when I got COVID. I got a pre-vaccines and all of that stuff. And it took me 6 or 7 weeks to really recover, like till I was able to work. I was in hospital like so many times. I was really sick. And afterwards it was just like, it did have an effect on me. Like, and there's these unknowns around the impact on your mental health after getting COVID. And I got the full whack of it, the second round of COVID, and I was in hospital and I was beside all the people. So yeah, COVID is, you know, one of the causes, I believe, for why I nosedived. But yeah, so I gave up everything like that. The only thing I don't really, haven't given up, is chocolate.
Well, that's a tough one. I wouldn't do that.
To give booze up than it is to give up chocolate.
Oh, no, thank you so much for this.
Nah, it's all good. No, thank you for doing it. Like, honestly, I've got a thing happening in September where I put an email out maybe about 6 weeks ago where I said, hey, listen, look, I was interviewing some people in the US. It's really difficult. That West Coast time zone is really difficult where I'm based in Dublin now, because family time is really important to me. 4:30, I collect the kids up. They go to bed around 7. So between the hours of 4:30 and 8, it's really difficult for me to interview people. And I put it out in the newsletter saying, hey, look, this is my quandary. Like, it's, I realize I'm interviewing more and more people that are kind of like in that Australian time zone and New Zealand and Asia and stuff. I said, I need some help. Hands up, who's anyone who's interested in doing a podcast, like a sub, like someone who can just sub in for me. Mm-hmm. Oh man, I did not think about that at all. Okay, like there was like, it was like 50 people responded with their hands up. And now I'm like, so Lisa, who works with me, she handles my calendar. She's like, what are you going to do with this? Like, I didn't think about it. I wrote that email at 4 o'clock and I sent it at 4:15. Now there's 50 people expecting that they're going to sub in for me and doing podcasts, but no podcast experience. So I gave up emailing them back after 4 or 5 people. I was like, oh, screw this. So I said, I'm just going to put a session on. So I put a session on for an hour and I don't know what I'm going to do in it, but I love hearing people start podcasts. Because what you're doing at the moment is really, really important. Okay. And we need more people doing it, believe it or not. Like, it's not a case of, just doing it for the crack. Having conversations is what makes us human. So kudos to you for putting yourself out there, because it takes confidence. It takes balls to push stuff out into the networks and say, here's something, let's talk about it. And I wish more people would do it, like, because it is very fulfilling when you make that connection with people. So fair play, as we say in Ireland, to you.
Thank you. Yeah, I didn't know when I started that it would take a lot of time and effort, to be honest. But yeah, when you start, you can't stop.
Consumes.
Really, really pleased you came. I've actually wanted to even reach out to you earlier, but I'm glad it came at this point in time, because we spoke about the new stuff you were working on as well.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to hearing more, and we're connected anyway, so...
Yeah, absolutely.
It starts with the gut. It ends with the gut. It's in your gut.
Gut Talks.